Because I was able to salvage a bit of good news from the wreckage doesn't mean there isn't a lot left to grieve. Castle is practically comatose. Kenji is the only one who's still trying to keep us alive. He's the only one with any sense of self-preservation left, and I think it's because of Castle, because no one is leading us anymore and someone has to step up. But even with Kenji doing his best to keep us focused, few of us are responding. The day has come to a close much more quickly than we could have expected, and the sun is setting fast, plunging us all into darkness. We're tired, we're broken, and we can no longer function. Sleep, it seems, is the only thing that will come. Chapter 12. James stirs in my arms. I'm awake in an instant, blinking fast and looking around to find everyone else still asleep. The sun slits open the horizon to let the light out, and the morning is so still and so quiet, it seems impossible there's ever been anything wrong. The truth, however, comes back too quickly. It's bricks on my chest, pressure in my lungs, aches in my joints, and metal in my mouth. Reminders of the long day, the longer night, and the boy curled up in my arms. Death and destruction, slivers of hope. Kenji drove us to a remote location and used the last of his strength to make the tank invisible for most of the night. It was the only way we could wait out the battle and manage to sleep for a few hours. I'm still not sure how that guy is functioning. He's definitely way stronger than I've ever given him credit for. The world around us is eerily calm. I shift a little and James is alert, up and asking questions the moment his mouth hinges open. His voice disturbs everyone, startling them awake. I use the back of my hand to rub at my eyes and adjust James in my lap, holding him close. I drop a kiss on the top of his head and tell him to be quiet.
Why?
He asks. I cover his mouth with my hand. He slaps it away.
Good morning, sunshine.
Kenji blinks in our direction.
Morning,
I say back.
I wasn't talking to you, he says, trying to smile. I was talking to the sunshine.
I grin in response, not really sure where we're going with this. There's so much to talk about and so much we don't want to talk about that I don't know if we'll ever talk at all. I glance back at Castle and notice he's wide awake and staring out the window. I wave hello.
Did you sleep all right?
I ask him. Castle stares at me. I glance at Kenji. Kenji looks out the window too. I blow out a breath. Everyone makes their way back to the present, slowly but surely. Once we're all in semi-working condition, Brendan and Winston included, Kenji doesn't waste any time.
We have to figure out where we're going to go, he says. We can't risk being on the road for too long, and I'm not sure how long or how well I'll be able to project. My energy is coming back, but slowly, and it's in and out. Not something I can rely on right now.
We also need to think about food,
Ian says groggily.
Yeah, I'm pretty hungry, James adds.
I squeeze his shoulders. We're all starving.
Right,
Kenji says.
So does anyone have any ideas?
Silence from all of us.
Come on, guys,
he says.
Think. Any hideouts, any secure spots? Anywhere you've ever crashed that was once a safe space?
What about our old house?
James asks, looking around. I sit up straighter, surprised I hadn't thought of it myself.
Right, of course, I say. Good idea, James.
I muss his hair. That would work. Kenji pounds his fist on the steering wheel.
Yes,
he says loudly.
Good, excellent, perfect, thank God.
But what if they come looking for us?
Lily asks.
Didn't Warner know about your old place?
Yeah, I tell her. But if they think everyone from Omega Point is dead, they won't think to come search for me or any of us. At that, the car goes dead quiet. The elephant in the room has made an appearance, and now no one knows what to say. We all look to Castle for direction on how best to proceed, but he doesn't say a word. He's staring straight ahead at nothing at all, like he's been paralyzed from the inside.
Let's go,
Aaliyah says quietly. She's the only one who responds to me, and she offers me a kind smile as she does. I decide I like her for it.
We should secure shelter as soon as possible, and maybe find James something to eat.
I beam at her, so touched that she would speak for James.
Maybe we could find something all of us could eat,
Ian cuts in, grumpy. I frown, but I can't blame him. My stomach has made a few protests of its own. We should have plenty of food back at the house, I say. It's been paid for through the end of the year, so we'll have just about everything we need. Water, electricity, a roof over our heads. But it'll be tight, and it'll be temporary. We'll have to come up with a more long-term solution soon.
Sounds good,
Kenji says to me. He turns back to look at everyone.
We all in agreement here?
There's a murmur of consent, and that's all we need, really, before we're off and heading back to my old place. Back to the beginning. Relief floods through me. I'm so grateful to be able to take James home, to let him sleep in his own bed. And though I know better than to ever say it out loud, a small part of me is happy that our time at Omega Point is officially over. There's a silver lining in all of this, and it's that Warner thinks we're all dead. And even though he's got Juliet now, he won't have her forever. She'll be safe until we can find a way to get her back, and until then, he won't come after us. We can find a way to live away from all the violence and destruction. Besides, I'm tired of fighting. I'm tired of being on the run and always having to risk my life and constantly worrying about James. I just want to go home. I want to take care of my brother, and I never, ever, ever want to feel what I felt last night. I can't risk losing James. Not ever again. Chapter 13. The roads are almost entirely abandoned. The sun is high and the wind is bitingly cold, and though the rain has stopped, the air smells like snow, and I have a feeling it's going to be harsh. I wrap James more tightly in my arms, shivering against a chill coming from deep inside my body. He's fallen asleep again, his small face buried in the crook of my neck. I hug him closer to my chest. With the opposition destroyed, there's no need to have many, if any, troops on the ground. They're probably clearing out the bodies now, cleaning up the mess and putting things back in order as soon as possible. It's what we always did. Battle was necessary, but cleaning it up was just as crucial. Warner used to drill that home. We were never to allow civilians time to grieve. We could never give them the opportunity to make martyrs of their loved ones. No, it was better for the deaths to seem as insignificant as possible. Everyone had to go back to work right away. So many times I was a part of those missions. I always hated Warner, hated the reestablishment and all it stood for, but now I feel even more strongly about it all. Thinking I'd lost James did something to me last night, and the damage is irreparable. I thought I knew what it was like to lose someone close to me, but I didn't. Not really. Losing a parent is excruciating, but somehow the pain is so much different from losing a child. And James, to me, in many ways feels like my own kid. I raised him, took care of him, protected him, fed him and clothed him, taught him most everything he knows. He's my only hope in all this devastation, the one thing I've always lived for, always fought for. I'd be lost without him. James gives my life purpose. And I didn't realize this until last night. What the reestablishment does, separating parents from their children, separating spouses from each other, basically ripping families apart, they do it on purpose. And the cruelty of these actions hadn't really hit me until now. I don't think I could ever be a part of something like that again. Chapter 14. We pull into the underground parking garage without a problem, and once we're inside, I can exhale.
I know we'll be safe here. The nine of us clamber out of the tank and stand around for a moment. Brendan and Winston are holding fast to each other, still recovering from their wounds. I'm not sure what happened to them exactly, because no one is talking about it, but I don't think I want to know. Aaliyah and Lily help Castle down from the tank, and Ian is close behind. Kenji is standing next to me. I'm still holding James in my arms, and I only put him down after he asks me to. You guys ready to go up? I ask. Shower? Eat some breakfast?
That sounds great, man, says Ian.
Everyone else agrees. I lead the way, James clinging to my hand. It's crazy. The last time we were here, we were on the run from Warner. Me and Juliet. It was the first time she met James, the first time it felt like we could really have a life together. And then Kenji showed up and redirected the course of everything. I shake my head, remembering. It feels like a million years ago somehow. So much has changed. I was practically a different guy back then. I feel much older and harder and angrier now. Difficult to believe it was only a few months ago. The front door is still messed up from when Warner and his guys busted it open, but we make do. I yank on the handle and then shove hard, and the door swings inward. Suddenly, we're all crossing the threshold. I'm looking around, amazed to see everything almost exactly the way we left it. A few things are knocked over and the place needs a serious cleaning, but it'll work. It'll be a great, safe place to live for a while. I start flipping switches and the small rooms flicker to life, fluorescent lights humming steadily in the silence. James bolts toward his bedroom and I check the cabinets for canned goods and non-perishable items. We've still got tons of saran-wrapped packages for the automat. I breathe a sigh of relief. Who wants breakfast? I ask, holding up a few packets. Kenji falls to his knees, shouting, "Hallelujah!" in the process. Ian practically tackles me. James comes racing out of his room, shouting, me, I do, and Lily laughs her head off. Aaliyah smiles and leans against the wall as Brendan and Winston collapse on the couch, groaning in relief. Castle is the only one who remains silent.
All right, everyone, Kenji says. Adam and I will get the food going, and the rest of you can take turns washing up. Also, I hate to be super obvious here, but there's only one bathroom, and we all have to share, so let's please be aware of that. Adam's got some supplies, but not too much, so let's be frugal, okay? Let's remember we're living on rations now. Consideration is crucial.
There's general consent and lots of nodding, and everyone busies themselves with a different kind of preparation. Everyone except Castle, who sits down in the single armchair and doesn't move. He seems to be doing worse than Brendan and Winston, who happen to be in actual physical pain. I'm still staring at the two of them when Ian slips away from the group to ask me if I have anything to help patch up Brendan and Winston. I assure him that I'll use whatever supplies I've got to fix them up as best I can. I always have a little medical kit at home, but it's not extensive, and I'm not a medic. But I know enough. I think I'll be able to help. This cheers up Ian significantly. It's only once Kenji and I are busy preparing food in the kitchen that he brings up the most pressing issue, the one I'm still not sure how to resolve.
So what are we going to do about Juliet?
Kenji asks, tossing an automat packet into a bowl.
I'm already worried we waited this long to go after her.
I feel myself pale. I don't know how to tell him I had no immediate plans to go back out there. Certainly not to fight, not after what happened to James. I don't know, I say. I'm not sure what we can do. Kenji stares at me, confused.
What do you mean? We have to get her out of there, which means we have to break her out of there, which means we've got to plan another rescue mission.
He shoots me a look.
I thought that was obvious.
I clear my throat. But what about James and Brendan and Winston and Castle? We're not doing too well over here. Is it okay to just leave them here and...
Dude, what the hell are you talking about? Are you in love with this girl?
Where's the fire under your ass? I thought you would be dying to get to her right now.
I am, I say urgently. Of course I am. I'm just worried. It's so soon after they bombed Point that I just...
The longer we wait, the worse it's going to get.
Kenji shakes his head.
We have to go as soon as possible. If we don't, she'll be stuck there forever, and Warner will use her as his torture monster. He'll probably kill her in the process, without even meaning to.
I grip the edge of the counter and stare into the sink. Shit. Shit, shit, shit. I spin around at the sound of James's voice, listen for a moment as he laughs at something Aaliyah said. My heart constricts just thinking about walking away from him again. But I know I have a responsibility to Juliet. What would she do if I weren't there to help her? She needs me. Okay, I sigh. Of course. What do we have to do? Chapter 15. After breakfast, which was actually closer to lunch, I tend to Brendan and Winston for a bit and set them up on the floor so they can get some proper rest. James and I had collected a decent stash of ratty blankets and pillows over the years, so there's just enough to go around, and thank God for that, because it's cold as hell. We even wrapped a blanket around Castle's shoulders. He's still barely moving, but we forced him to eat, so at least he's got a little color in his cheeks now. With Brendan and Winston settled, Ian and Aaliyah and Lily fed and comfortable, James safe and sound, and Castle resting, Kenji and I are finally ready to initiate some new plans.
I'm going to go out, Kenji says. Get on base and get nosy. Listen for rumors and whispers of what's going on. Maybe even find Juliet, give her a heads up that we're coming for her soon.
I nod. That's a great start.
Once I know more about what's going on, we can make a firm plan, scoop her up, and bring her home.
So as soon as she's back, I say, we'll have to move again.
Probably, yeah.
I nod a few times. Okay, all right. I swallow hard. I'll wait here until you get back.
Sounds good.
Kenji grins, and then he's gone. Disappeared. The front door is yanked open and yanked closed, and I'm staring at the wall and trying not to freak out too much about what's going to happen next. Another mission, which means another chance to screw everything up and get ourselves killed. And then, if we're successful, we're rewarded with more running, more instability, more chaos. I close my eyes. I love Juliet. I really do. I want to help her and support her and be there for her. I want us to have a future together. But sometimes I wonder if it's ever going to happen. This isn't easy to admit, but part of me doesn't want to put James at risk again, on the run again, for a girl who broke up with me, a girl who walked away from us. I don't know what the right thing is anymore. I don't know if my allegiance is to James or Juliet. Chapter 16. Kenji is back after only a couple of hours, his face ashen, his hands trembling. He's breathing hard and his eyes are unfocused and he sits down on the couch without a word and I'm already panicking. What happened? I ask.
What's going on? Lily says. You okay, bro?
This from Ian. We pepper him with questions and he doesn't answer. He stares unblinking, a replica of Castle who's sitting in a chair across from him. Finally, after a long moment of silence, he speaks. Three words.
Juliet is dead.
Chaos. Questions are flying and screams are muffled and everyone is shocked, horrified, freaking out. I'm stunned. My brain feels paralyzed, unwilling to process or digest this information. Why, I want to ask. How is it possible? But I can't speak. I'm frozen in horror, grief.
It wasn't Warner who came after her,
Kenji is saying, tears falling fast down his face.
It was Anderson. Those were Anderson's men. They made the announcement just a couple hours ago,
he says, choking on the words.
They said they bombed Omega Point, captured Juliet, and killed her just this morning. The Supreme has already headed back to the capital.
No, I gasp.
We should have gone after her, Kenji is saying. I should have stayed behind. I should have tried to find her. It's my fault, he says, hands in his hair, fighting back tears. It's my fault she's dead. I should have gone after her.
It's not your fault, Ian says to him, rushing over and grabbing his arms.
Don't you dare put that on yourself.
We lost a lot of people, Lily says. People dear to us that we couldn't save. This is not your fault, I promise. We did our best.
Everyone is consoling Kenji now, trying to reassure him that there's no guilt necessary, no person to blame for all this. But I can't agree. I trip backward until I hit the wall, leaning against it for support. I know who to blame. I know where the fault lies. Juliet is dead because of me.
Juliet's journal. I keep thinking I need to stay calm, that it's all in my head, that everything is going to be fine and someone is going to open the door now. Someone is going to let me out of here. I keep thinking it's going to happen. I keep thinking it has to happen because things like this don't just happen. This doesn't happen. People aren't forgotten like this, not abandoned like this. This doesn't just happen. My face is caked with blood from when they threw me on the ground, and my hands are still shaking even as I write this. This pen is my only outlet, my only voice, because I have no one else to speak to, no mind but my own to drown in, and all the lifeboats are taken, and all the life preservers are broken, and I don't know how to swim. I can't swim. I can't swim, and it's getting so hard. It's getting so hard. It's like there are a million screams caught inside of my chest, but I have to keep them all in, because what's the point of screaming if you'll never be heard? And no one will ever hear me in here. No one will ever hear me. Ever again. I've learned to stare at things. The walls, my hands, the cracks in the walls, the lines on my fingers, the shades of gray in the concrete, the shape of my fingernails. I pick one thing and I stare at it for what must be hours. I keep time in my head by counting the seconds as they pass. I keep days in my head by writing them down. Today is day two. Today is the second day. Today is a day. Today. It's so cold. It's so cold. It's so cold. Please, please, please. I started screaming today. It's a strange thing to never know peace. To know that no matter where you go, there is no sanctuary, that the threat of pain is always a whisper away. I'm not safe locked into these four walls. I was never safe leaving my house, and I couldn't even feel safe in the 14 years I lived at home. The asylum kills people every day. The world has already been taught to fear me, and my home is the same place where my father locked me in my room every night and my mother screamed at me for being the abomination she was forced to raise. She always said it was my face. There was something about my face, she said, that she couldn't stand. Something about my eyes, the way I looked at her. The fact that I even existed. She'd always tell me to stop looking at her. She'd always scream it like I might attack her. Stop looking at me, she'd scream. You just stop looking at me, she'd scream. She put my hand in the fire once. Just to see if it would burn, she said. Just to check if it was a regular hand, she said. I was 6 years old then. I remember because it was my birthday. Am I insane yet? Has it happened yet? How will I ever know? Sometimes I close my eyes and paint these walls in a different color. I imagine I'm wearing warm socks and sitting by a fire. I imagine someone's given me a book to read, a story to take me away from the torture of my own mind. I want to be someone else, somewhere else, with something else to fill my mind. I want to run, to feel the wind tug at my hair. I want to pretend that this is just a story within a story, that this cell is just a scene, that these hands don't belong to me, that this window leads to somewhere beautiful. If only I could break it. I pretend this pillow is clean. I pretend this bed is soft. I pretend and pretend and pretend until the world becomes so breathtaking behind my eyelids that I can no longer contain it. But then my eyes fly open and I'm caught around the throat by a pair of hands that won't stop suffocating, suffocating, suffocating. My thoughts, I think, will soon be sound. My mind, I hope, will soon be found. I wonder what they're thinking, my parents. I wonder where they are. I wonder if they're okay now, if they're happy now, if they finally got what they wanted. I wonder if my mother will ever have another child. I wonder if someone will ever be kind enough to kill me, and I wonder if hell is better than here. I wonder what my face looks like now. I wonder if I'll ever breathe fresh air again. I wonder about so many things. Sometimes I'll stay awake for days just counting everything I can find. I count the walls, the cracks in the walls, my fingers and toes. I count the springs in the bed, the threads in the blanket, the steps it takes to cross the room and back. I count my teeth and the individual hairs on my head and the number of seconds I can hold my breath. Sometimes I get so tired that I forget I'm not allowed to wish for things anymore, and I find myself wishing for the one thing I've always wanted, the one thing I've always dreamt about. I wish all the time for a friend. I dream about it. I imagine what it would be like to smile and be smiled upon, to have a person to confide in. Someone who wouldn't throw things at me or stick my hands in the fire or beat me for being born. Someone who would hear that I've been thrown away and would try to find me. Who would never be afraid of me. Someone who'd know I'd never try to hurt them. I fold myself into a corner of this room and bury my head in my knees and rock back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And I wish and I wish and I wish and I dream of impossible things until I've cried myself to sleep. I wonder what it would be like to have a friend. And then I wonder who else is locked in this asylum. I wonder where the other screams are coming from. I wonder if they're coming from me. There's something simmering inside of me. Something I've never dared to tap into. Something I'm afraid to acknowledge. There's a part of me clawing to break free from the cage I've trapped it in. Banging on the doors of my heart. Begging to be free. Begging to let go. Every day I feel like I'm reliving the same nightmare. I open my mouth to shout, to fight, to swing my fists, but my vocal cords are cut. My arms are heavy and weighted down as if trapped in wet cement, and I'm screaming, but no one can hear me. No one can reach me, and I'm caught, and it's killing me. I've always had to make myself submissive, subservient, twisted into a pleading, passive mop just to make everyone else feel safe and comfortable. My existence has become a fight to prove I'm harmless, that I'm not a threat, that I'm capable of living among other human beings without hurting them. And I'm so tired. I'm so tired. I'm so tired. I'm so tired. And sometimes I get so angry. I don't know what's happening to me. We had homes before, all different kinds, One-story homes, two-story homes, three-story homes. We bought lawn ornaments and twinkle lights, learned to ride bikes without training wheels. We purchased lives confined within one, two, three stories already built, stories caught inside of structures we could not change. We lived in those stories for a while. We followed the tale laid out for us, the prose pinned down in every square foot of space we'd acquired. We were content with the plot twists that only mildly redirected our lives. We signed on the dotted line for the things we didn't know we cared about. We ate the things we shouldn't, spent money where we couldn't, lost sight of the earth we had to inhabit, and wasted everything. Food, water, resources. Soon the skies were gray with chemical pollution, and the plants and animals were sick from genetic modification, and diseases rooted themselves in our air, our meals, our blood and bones. The food disappeared. The people were dying. Our empire fell to pieces. The reestablishment said they would help us, save us, rebuild our society. Instead, they tore us all apart. I'm sorry, I'm so 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 sorry. I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, 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 I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. It was an accident. Forgive me. Please forgive me. Swallow the tears back often enough and they'll start feeling like acid dripping down your throat. It's that terrible moment when you're sitting still, so still, so still because you don't want them to see you cry. You don't want to cry, but your lips won't stop trembling and your eyes are filled to the brim with please. And I beg you, and please, and I'm sorry, and please, and have mercy, and maybe this time it'll be different, but it's always the same. There's no one to run to for comfort, no one on your side. Light a candle for me, I used to whisper to no one. Someone. Anyone, if you're out there, please tell me you can feel this fire. These letters are all I have left. 26 friends to tell my stories to. 26 letters are all I need. I can stitch them together to create oceans and ecosystems. I can fit them together to form planets and solar systems. I can use letters to construct skyscrapers and metropolitan cities populated by people, places, things, and ideas that are more real to me than these four walls. I need nothing but letters to live. Without them, I would not exist. Because these words I write down are the only proof I have that I'm still alive. Sometimes I think the shadows are moving. Sometimes I think someone might be watching. Sometimes this idea scares me, and sometimes the idea makes me so absurdly happy I can't stop crying. And then sometimes I think I have no idea when I started losing my mind in here. Nothing seems real anymore, and I can't tell if I'm screaming out loud or only in my head. There's no one here to hear me. To tell me I'm not dead. No one wants a dandelion. They crop up all over the place, ugly and unfortunate, an average blossom in a world desperately seeking beauty. They're weeds, people say. They're uninteresting and offer no fragrance, and there are too many of them, too much of them. We don't want them. Destroy them. Dandelions are a nuisance. We desire the buttercups, the daffodils, the morning glories. We want the azalea, the poinsettia, the calla lily. We pluck them from our gardens and plant them in our homes, and we don't seem to remember their toxic nature. We don't seem to care that if you get too close, if you take a small bite, the beauty is replaced with pain and laced with a poison that laughs in your blood, destroys your organs, infects your heart. But pick a dandelion. Pick a dandelion and make a salad. Eat the leaves, the flower, the stem. Thread it in your hair. Plant it in the ground and watch it thrive. Pick a dandelion and close your eyes. Make a wish. Blow it into the wind. Watch it change the world. Hate. It's poison, an unrelenting punch to the gut, an injustice injected directly into your bloodstream that slowly paralyzes your organs until you can't breathe. You can't breathe. Because loneliness has stuffed itself into your clothes, and you're rotting to death in a dark corner of the world, and you're already forgotten. You never even were. Pick a cloud just to pin it down and wear it in your hair. Jump up to catch its soft, soft strands, its feathery wisps. Piles of tufted snow sailing through the air, cotton candy stretched so thin it melts the moment you try to taste it. Life is like a cloud. It comes in a million shapes and sizes, and it offers no guarantees, no certainties, no sympathies for the man who told his kid he'd fly a kite today. No consideration for the girl who was sure she'd see the sun today. No promises for the weary world and the wants, wants, wants of which it has too many today. Life is like that. Sometimes full and fluffy and floating along, and sometimes dark and angry and sobbing, 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 anger and passion and vengeance and retaliation. It's agony. It's anguish. It's a gift. A lesson, a reminder. Because only once the storm has passed, only once the tears have flooded the rivers and gorged the ground and washed away the dirt, the debris, the destruction and decay, only then will the sun step outside, smile to the sky, and dare to shine. I count everything, even numbers. Odd numbers, multiples of 10. I count the ticks of the clock. I count the talks of the clock. I count the lines between the lines on a sheet of paper. I count the broken beats of my heart. I count my pulse and my blinks and the number of tries it takes to inhale enough oxygen for my lungs. I stay like this. I stand like this. I count like this until the feeling stops. Until the tears stop spilling. Until my fists stop shaking, until my heart stops aching. There are never enough numbers. Loneliness is a strange sort of thing. It creeps up on you, quiet and still, sits by your side in the dark, strokes your hair as you sleep. It wraps itself around your bones, squeezing so tight you almost can't breathe, almost can't hear the pulse racing in your blood as it rushes up your skin and touches its lips to the soft hairs at the back of your neck. It leaves lies in your heart, lies next to you at night, leeches the light out from every corner. It's a constant companion, clasping your hand only to yank you down when you're struggling to stand up, catching your tears only to force them down your throat. It scares you simply by standing by your side. You wake up in the morning and wonder who you are. You fail to fall asleep at night and tremble in your skin. You doubt, you doubt, you doubt. Do I? Don't I? Should I? Why won't I? And even when you're ready to let go, when you're ready to break free, when you're ready to be brand new, loneliness is an old friend standing beside you in the mirror, looking you in the eye, challenging you to live your life without it. You can't find the words to fight yourself, to fight the words screaming that you're not enough, never enough, never ever enough. Loneliness is a bitter, wretched companion. Sometimes it just won't let go. I am a thief. I stole this notebook and this pen from one of the doctors, from one of his lab coats when he wasn't looking, and I shoved them both down my pants. This was just before he ordered those men to come and get me. The ones in the strange suits with the thick gloves and the gas masks with the foggy plastic windows hiding their eyes. They were aliens, I remember thinking. I remember thinking they must have been aliens because they couldn't have been human. The ones who handcuffed my hands behind my back, the ones who strapped me to my seat. They stuck tasers to my skin over and over for no reason other than to hear me scream, but I wouldn't. I whimpered, but I never said a word. I felt the tears streak down my cheeks, but I wasn't crying. I think it made them angry. They slapped me awake even though my eyes were open when we arrived. Someone unstrapped me without removing my handcuffs and kicked me in both kneecaps before ordering me to rise. And I tried. I tried, but I couldn't. And finally, six hands shoved me out the door and my face was bleeding on the concrete for a while. I can't really remember the part where they dragged me inside. I feel cold all the time. I feel empty, like there is nothing inside of me but this broken heart. The only organ left in this shell. I feel the bleats echo within me. I feel the thumping reverberate around my skeleton. I have a heart, says science, but I am a monster, says society. And I know it. Of course I know it. I know what I've done. I'm not asking for sympathy. But sometimes I wonder, if I were a monster, surely I would feel it by now. I would feel angry and vicious and vengeful. I'd know blind rage and bloodlust and a need for vindication. Instead, I feel an abyss within me that's so deep, so dark, I can't see within it. I can't see what it holds. I do not know what I am or what might happen to me. I do not know what I might do again. I sit here every day, 174, 175 days I've sat here so far. Some days I stand up and stretch and feel these stiff bones, these creaky joints, this trampled spirit cramped inside my being. I roll my shoulders, I blink my eyes, I count the seconds creeping up the walls, the minutes shivering under my skin, the breaths I have to remember to take. Sometimes I allow my mouth to drop open, just a little bit. I touch my tongue to the backs of my teeth and the seam of my lips, and I walk around this small space. I trail my finger along the cracks in the concrete and wonder. I wonder what it would be like to speak out loud and be heard. I hold my breath. Listen closely for anything, any sound of life, and wonder at the beauty, the impossibility of possibly hearing another person breathing beside me. I stop. I stand still. I close my eyes and I try to remember a world beyond these walls. I wonder what it would be like to know that I'm not dreaming, that this isolated existence is not caged within my own mind. And I do wonder. I think about it all the time. What it would be like to kill myself. Because I never really know. I still can't tell the difference. I'm never quite certain whether or not I'm actually alive. So I sit here. I sit here every day. Run, I said to myself. Run until your lungs collapse, until the wind whips and snaps at your tattered clothes, until you're a blur that blends into the background. Run, Juliet, run faster, run until your bones break and your shins split and your muscles atrophy and your heart dies because it was always too big for your chest and it beat too fast for too long, and run, 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 run until you can't hear their feet behind you. Run until they drop their fists and their shouts dissolve in the air. Run with your eyes open and your mouth shut, and damn the river rushing up behind your eyes. Run, Juliet. Run until you drop dead. Make sure your heart stops before they ever reach you, before they ever touch you. Run, I said. Just a moment. Just 1 second. Just one more minute. Just give me another hour, or maybe this weekend, to think it over. It's not so much. It's not so hard. It's all we ever ask for. It's a simple request. But the moments, the seconds, the minutes, the hours, the days and years become one big mistake. One extraordinary opportunity slipped right through our fingers because we couldn't decide. We couldn't understand. We needed more time. We didn't know what to do. We don't even know what we've done. We have no idea how we even got here when all we ever wanted was to wake up in the morning and go to sleep at night and maybe stop for ice cream on the way home. And that one decision, that one choice, that one accidental opportunity unraveled everything we've ever known and ever believed in. And what do we do? What do we do from here? On the darkest days, you have to search for a spot of brightness. On the coldest days, you have to seek out a spot of warmth. On the bleakest days, you have to keep your eyes onward and upward, and on the saddest days, you have to leave them open to let them cry, to then let them dry, to give them a chance to wash out the pain in order to see fresh and clear once again. Nothing in this life will ever make sense to me, but I can't help but try to collect the change and hope it's enough to pay for our mistakes. I am not insane. 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 I'm not insane. I am 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 not insane. I'm not insane. I am 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 not insane. I'm not insane. I am not insane. I am not insane. I'm not insane. I am 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 not insane. I don't know when it started. I don't know why it started. I don't know anything about anything except for the screaming. My mother screaming when she realized she could no longer touch me. My father screaming when he realized what I'd done to my mother. My parents screaming when they'd lock me in my room and tell me I should be grateful for their food, for their humane treatment of this thing that could not possibly be their child, for the yardstick they used to measure the distance I needed to keep away. I ruined their lives, is what they said to me. I stole their happiness, destroyed my mother's hope for ever having children again. Couldn't I see what I'd done, is what they'd ask me? Couldn't I see that I'd ruined everything? I tried so hard to fix what I had ruined. I tried every single day to be what they wanted. I tried all the time to be better, but I never really knew how. I only know now that the scientists are wrong. The world is flat. I know because I was tossed right off the edge and I've been trying to hold on for 17 years. I've been trying to climb back up for 17 years, but it's nearly impossible to beat gravity when no one is willing to give you a hand. When no one wants to risk touching you. One word, two lips, 3, 4, 5 fingers form one fist. One corner, two parents, 3, 4, 5 reasons to hide. One child, two eyes, 3, 4, 17 years of fear. A broken broomstick, a pair of wild faces, angry whispers, locks on my door. Look at me is what I wanted to say to you. Talk to me every once in a while. Find me a cure for these tears. I'd really like to exhale for the first time in my life. The broken broomstick was the mediator between me and them. The broomstick broke on my back. I remember televisions and fireplaces and porcelain sinks. I remember movie tickets and parking lots and SUVs. I remember hair salons and holidays and window shutters and dandelions and the smell of freshly paved driveways. I remember toothpaste commercials and ladies in high heels and old men in business suits. I remember mailmen and libraries and boy bands and balloons and Christmas trees. I remember being 10 years old when we couldn't ignore the food shortages anymore and things got so expensive no one could afford to live. Why don't you just kill yourself? Someone at school asked me once. I think it was the kind of question intended to be cruel, but it was the first time I'd ever contemplated the possibility. I didn't know what to say. Maybe I was crazy to consider it, but I'd always hoped that if I were a good enough girl, if I did everything right, if I said the right things or said nothing at all, I thought my parents would change their minds. I thought they would finally listen when I tried to talk. I thought they would give me a chance. I thought they might finally love me. I always had that stupid hope. There's no light in here. I'm not sure if I'm writing on paper or skin or stone, but were you happy? Were you sad? Were you scared? Were you mad the first time you screamed? Were you fighting for your life, your decency, your dignity, your humanity? When someone touches you now, do you scream? When someone smiles at you now, do you smile back? Did he tell you not to scream? Did he hit you when you cried? Did he have one nose, two eyes, two lips, two cheeks, two ears, two eyebrows? Was he one human who looked just like you? Color your personality. Shapes and sizes are variety. Your heart is an anomaly. Your actions are the only traces you leave behind. Hang tight. Hold on. Look up. Stay strong. Hang on. Hold tight. Look strong. Stay up. One day I might break. One day I might break free.
This is James Foey. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Unite Me by Tahira Mafi. Presented by HarperCollins and Harper Audio. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Caitlin Guerin. Text copyright 2012, 2013, 2014 by Tahira Mafi. Production copyright 2019 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.